period of Saul, still in the Iron Age, is from 1020 to about 1000 BC. Then the reign of David, approximately 1000 to 960, a lot of times it's 961. And then Solomon from 960 to 922. And of course, 922 marks not only the death of Solomon, but the beginning of the so-called divided kingdom. In Old Testament studies, you will see the period of David and Solomon referred to as the United Monarchy, and then after 922, the divided kingdoms. One other comment, perhaps, is just to mention that Saul and Samuel, you could put Saul and Samuel together right in this period around 1020 to 1000 BC. So tonight, what we're going to be talking about is the period of the Judges, the biblical account of what's happening during this period, what characterized the ancient still proto-Israelites during this period, then how it came to be that Saul rose to power, what impact he had on this part of the world. And then, of course, we'll be talking about some of the archaeological evidence, which coincides with these particular periods. We've mentioned several times a very important passage, and that is Joshua chapter 24, which is often referred to as the convocation of Shechem, where Joshua gathered the troops together, and everybody took, in a sense, a pledge of allegiance to be Yahweh worshippers, and Yahweh being the personal name of the Hebrew God. That passage is one that a lot of Old Testament scholars will point to, emphasizing that the early Israelite period, the political and religious structure was that of a tribal confederacy, which was basically a theocracy. That is, the thing that held the early Hebrew tribes together was not a strong political organization, but it was a common commitment to a certain type of worship or a certain deity. And so you'll find, again, a lot of the people emphasizing that it's the religious element that held all these tribes together, not a political element. That's a bit overstated, or at least it seems to me, because in the ancient Near East, politics and religion went very close together, as in some cases they still do today. Certainly, in the ancient Near East, if you were, say, a loyal subject in Babylon, you would, if you pledged loyalty to the state god, Marduk, you would at the same time simultaneously be stating loyalty to the king, because the king was in fact, or at least the office of the king, was seen as being a divine office, and even more so in Egypt. So in a sense, what the Israelites did in saying that they would strictly worship Yahweh and none of the other gods, what they were doing in a sense was declaring their political independence, saying that they would not be loyal to any of the city-states in Palestine or subjugate themselves to the political rule of any of the petty kings or any of the kings of the nation. We know that initially the sanctuary, central sanctuary, was located at Shechem. Then we're told at the beginning of the book of Judges that it's moved to Bethel for a short period of time, and then finally at Shechem, or finally at Shiloh. It would appear that in this early period, the Hebrew tribes didn't come together very often. The major meetings were probably the three major religious festivals, which, as in the Canaanite system, coincided with the barley harvest, which was the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is also associated with Passover, the Feast of Booths, or the wheat harvest, which has come over in Christian tradition as Pentecost, and then in fall, It was the Feast of Tabernacles or the Fruit Harvest, which also coincided or came very near the celebration of the New Year. New Year was celebrated at the beginning of the reign of Paul. But it appears that just during these three major religious festivals that the tribes or these leaders of the tribes would gather at the central sanctuary and then more or less go their own way. Leadership during the period of the judges was not unified. It appears, and again, it's hard to pull it all together. We're dealing basically now with the sources in the book of Judges and the first 11 chapters of the book of Samuel. But it would appear that each individual tribe was led by or under the jurisdiction of a so-called judge. Judges are often categorized as in two ways, the so-called minor judges, whose function appears to have been strictly judicial. That is, they would act as an arbitrator in disputes, as kind of a check if anybody had a legal dispute or an argument with their relatives or if a neighboring clan, they would come to the judge for a legal judgment. And it appears that all of the judges in the Old Testament during this period from 1200 to 1020 had that kind of a judicial function. In addition, a number of the judges, the so-called major judges, also functioned as leaders in military campaigns. And especially in this latter case, when a judge would assume the role of general, he would often exercise his power or her power, because there were female judges of Israel as well, over not simply one tribe, but perhaps a conglomeration of tribes, whoever volunteered or signed up to fight the enemy. It's very difficult to sort out chronologically which judge followed the other, because the presentation in the Book of Judges doesn't appear to be chronological. There's overlapping. It appears that some judges may have been contemporary, somebody judging and leading military campaigns in the north and others in the south. Certainly from the number of battles that the judges led the Israelites into, it's clear that, again, the conquest of Joshua had not been complete. There were still Canaanites in the land, there were still Philistines in the land, and in fact, at this period, it would still appear that the Israelites are in the minority. Certainly they're not politically or militarily they're at a disadvantage still during this period. Rather than talk about a lot of the individual judges, I thought I might pick out one example. That is the judge Deborah, and you can read about her in the book of Judges, chapter 4 and then chapter 5. Chapter 4 is a prose narrative of some of her exploits, and chapter 5 is a poetic version of the so-called Battle of Megiddo. It's a very interesting chapter, chapter 5. It's considered to be one of the oldest, if not the oldest, section in the Old Testament. And that kind of a judgment is based on the fact that if you read the Hebrew text of Judges chapter 5, you find a lot of archaic Hebrew forms that dropped out at a later period and aren't reflected in most sections of the biblical text. So, from chapter 4 of Judges, we find that Deborah was judging, doing her thing, in the vicinity of Bethel, just north of Jerusalem. But what she's, so she did have that judicial function. What she's best known for, though, is the Battle of Megiddo, which we think probably took place around 1125, or at least that is the dating on the basis of the orthography, the style of the Hebrew text. That's when most people would date that particular poem in 35, so assuming that the battle took place right about that time. 1125 BC, or 1126. A careful reading of the account of that battle, perhaps I should just summarize it very briefly. Deborah goes into battle. It's got its humorous aspects. Balak is the fellow that is kind of leading as the general, and Balak in Hebrew means lightning, and the impression you get from the text is here Deborah is having to almost kick this guy into the battlefield. He doesn't want to go, he doesn't want to go to very good chance of winning and so forth. So you get Deborah pushing him into the battlefield near Ta'anak, which is right along one of the major sites. There's Ta'anak and then Megiddo, right on the southern edge of the Esdraelon Valley, one of the major fertile plains on the west bank, and one of the places where battles have, probably more battles in Palestine have taken place in Esdraelon than in the place that's visited favor. In any case, the story tells about Deborah summoning up all of the tribes of Israel to go to war against the Canaanite general Sisera. Again, there's different descriptions in chapter 4, chapter 5. Chapter 5, 4 says that simply that the Lord or Yahweh smokes the Canaanites at the edge of the sword. Chapter 5, the poetic version, talks about a rainstorm coming down and bogging down the chariot of Sisera the Canaanite. You might remember what happens next. Then he manages to escape to a Canaanite woman, Jael. She offers him hospitality and gets him into the tent, lets him go to sleep, and then drives the tent peg through his tongue. So that's roughly the story. One of the interesting features of the Battle of Megiddo, though, is that it said very explicitly that the tribes of Reuben, Gad, Dan, and Asher did not take part in the battle. Evidently, they were summoned, but they refused to come. Also, the tribe of Judah, Simeon, and Levi are not even mentioned, so they obviously also didn't take part. That seems to have been one of the major problems during the period of the judges, that whenever the tribes would come together, it was usually just those tribes in the immediate vicinity that were being threatened by the Canaanites or the Ammonites or the Philistines who would band together and fight, and those who were further away and not really endangered stayed away from the battle. At least that is the impression you get from the story of Deborah and other accounts of the exploits of the judges. I think we've also mentioned before that although initially the major enemy of these proto-Israelites, newly arrived Israelites and Hebrews, were the Canaanites. But about the same time that the Israelites arrived, the Philistines, the sea people, also arrived. The major disadvantage that the Israelites had in their battles against the Philistines was that the Philistines appear to have had a monopoly on iron technology. And that's reflected in the first book of Samuel, chapter 13, verses 19 and 20, where it said that the Israelites had to go to the Philistines in order to get their plowshares sharpened. Evidently, they were able to buy iron implements from the Philistines, but the Philistines did not share the technology and had to fear that the Israelites would make weapons from them. In any case, as time goes on in the period of the judges, one other thing I should mention about the appointment of judges, there doesn't seem to have been an elective system. The only description you get is that the Spirit of Yahweh would come upon somebody and empower them to lead people to battle. So therefore, the judges are often referred to as charismatic leaders. And it appears that as soon as the battle was over, a judge would retire, go back to the judicial functions, and not assume the political role of ruler. It was simply a leader. There are some exceptions to that. One noticeable one is Gideon. It's interesting. Gideon is offered kingship by the tribes after his victories in battle. And he says, no, I can't accept it. God only, or Yahweh, is your ruler, and I cannot usurp Yahweh's position. In fact, some recent literary studies of that particular passage question whether that is, in fact, a denial on Gideon's part or a refusal to accept the offer of king. There are some other ancient texts which indicate indicate that that's the kind of a response which today you might say, oh, shucks, I couldn't accept that, and then you take the position. So in any case, there are, Gideon's one example, and there are a couple others of judges who may have, in fact, accepted the role of king, but for a very short period of time. And certainly kingship never becomes a part of ancient Israel during this so-called period of judges. Near the end of the period, we can see that evidently the Israelites were gaining the upper hand on the Canaanites, probably helped out by the Philistines, because the Philistines were certainly rising to power faster than the Israelites were at this time. There's one very important passage in 1 Samuel chapter 4, I believe it is. Yeah. 1 Samuel 4, which tells about the capture of the Ark of the Covenant, which you remember is a little box containing the Ten Commandments and perhaps a few other items. The Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant from the Israelites that had been taken into battle from Shiloh. And that seems to be a traumatic enough event to have actually pulled the tribes together. Before that time, it was difficult to unify them. But the threat of the Philistines became so great that one event kind of set things off and set the stage for Saul's rise to power as a king. In fact, there's another thing that happens in 1 Samuel chapter 11. It tells of Saul going into battle against the Ammonites at Jabesh Gilead, which we think is probably somewhere in the northern Jordan Valley, or at least in the road going down to the Jordan Valley, but it's not been identified with any archaeological site that we know of, at least not certainly identified. During this time, the Ammonites were putting pressure on the Hebrew tribes that were settled in Transjordan. They had conquered Jabesh Gilead. Saul went over, reconquered it, and took it away from the Ammonites. And at that period, it appears that people then began asking Saul to be king. He's anointed by Samuel, who's an interesting character. He's kind of a combination of a judge, usually referred to as the last judge, but certainly also a priest that has some prophetic characteristics about him as well. Again, it's interesting to read those accounts in 1 Samuel 12. Again, not everybody is agreed on this, but it appears again as if you have two traditions which talk about the initial appointment of Saul to be king. The so-called pro-monarchical tradition and an anti-monarchical tradition. And you can find passages which very strongly support the idea that Saul is Yahweh's appointed king over the Israelites, and other passages which indicate clearly that the people want to have Saul as their king, but this is very objectionable, both to Samuel and to Yahweh himself. In any case, Saul does become king. It is interesting that kingship in ancient Israel from the time of Saul on is very different from kingship, at least as we know it from ancient texts, in Egypt and Mesopotamia. In Egypt, you have actually the divine king, where the pharaoh is said to be a god himself. In Mesopotamia, you have divine kingship, so that the mortal who becomes king is not a god or a divine personality, but he does assume a divine role or post. Kingship comes down from heaven, and therefore he's entitled to certain benefits and so forth. Whereas most ancient kings took a very leading role in the cult, worship and so forth, the sacrificial system and so all of that. In Israel, there was a fairly clear distinction between the church and the state. If you'll remember, one of the reasons that Samuel got so upset with Saul was that he officiated at a sacrifice before doing the battle. That was totally out of character for Saul, although it would have been very in character for a king of most any other state in this part of the world. Although Saul is talked about as being the first king of Israel. In many ways, he's the last judge, or at least his rule is characterized, is more similar to that of the judges than the kings, or David and Solomon, who followed. I say that because certainly he doesn't pass on kingship to his son, although he would like to have. Secondly, Saul didn't appear to have a standing army. He, like the judges, would rely on volunteers who would come together and help fight a certain battle, and then at the end of the battle, everybody, including Saul, would go back home. He certainly didn't build a palace. In fact, the only archaeological remains that we can identify definitely with the early Hebrews from the period of the judges up to Saul is a place called, in modern times, Tel El-Ful, the Tel of the Horsemen, which is located just a few miles north of Jerusalem. It was excavated in the 20s and then in the 30s by William Albright, and then in the 60s by Paul Lamp. It's a very small site, very crude, rough fort, in fact. And those excavations, it seems to be little doubt that that is, in fact, Gibeah Saul, which was his headquarters. Certainly, if that was his main headquarters, the archaeological excavations bear out the biblical account that Saul was not a grand king. But he, rather than sitting on his throne, if he had a throne, we don't even know that he had a throne, but if he did have a throne, then he wasn't there very often. He was usually off fighting battles. His initial victories were over the Ammonites. It appears that at that time, Ammon was on the move. I mentioned last time that the Ammonites appear to have risen a little bit later than the Moabites and the Edomites. One indication of that from the biblical text is that if you do look at some of the sections of the Old Testament which are identified because of the orthography, the style of writing and so forth, those oldest poems and songs refer to Edom and Moab, but not to Ammon. Ammon doesn't seem to be coming now until around this time when they are expanding down into the Jordan Valley. Saul defeats him at Jabesh Gilead. He doesn't seem to actually come in to Ammon proper, say, as far as the Moab. He then turns his attention to the Philistines, and from the biblical accounts, you might get the impression that Saul was very successful in mopping up the Philistines. In fact, what he did was basically a guerrilla warfare type thing, going around and attacking the Philistine garrisons in the central hill country on the west bank. So that in more of a hit and run operation, he was very effective in clearing out the Philistine presence, or at least it appears he was quite effective in clearing it out from the central hill country, which throughout this period had been where the Hebrews were concentrated. But the first time that Saul actually encounters the full brunt of the Philistine army in the Esdraelon Valley or the Valley of Jezreel near Gilboa, he's soundly defeated. That's the end of Saul and Jonathan, who would have been the successor. Okay. There's not too much we can say about Jordan during this early period, other than the fact that after the destruction of these late bronze sites, you do find small Iron Age, early Iron Age sites here in Jordan. I think we have already mentioned the fact that there's a lot less, almost no imported material, which was very dominant in the late bronze period. Pottery seems to be much cruder than it is in the late bronze period. So generally, the early Iron Age here in Jordan is pretty characterized as a period of poverty. It's certainly not as prosperous as it was in the preceding late bronze age. You have here the three major powers, the Ammonites in the north, the Moabites in the center part of the country, and the Edomites in the south, growing and developing probably just about like the Israelites were on the other side. hard to say exactly what happened to the Amorites. You'll remember that Sihon, king of the Amorites, was defeated, according to the biblical tradition, right around the Heshbon, Meriba, to the whole that area. And the tribe of Reuben settled in that area with Gad a little bit further north from Manasseh, up in the Ashdod. We just don't have enough archaeological data or really information from the biblical text itself to say what these tribes were doing during the period of the judges. If, in fact, Ruth was written at this time, remember the story of Ruth, who was a Moabite gal married to an Israelite fellow who died, and she ended up going back with Naomi, her mother-in-law, to Bethlehem and married Boaz and becoming the grandmother of King David. If, in fact, that book was written during the period of the Judges, which it claims to have been, in the first verse it says, these things took place when the Judges ruled. That would be an indication that relationships between the Israelite tribes and the Moabites were quite strong at that time. Or at least there seems to be nothing in the book to reflect a tense situation. The fact that there is intermarriage and there's no question about it, that Naomi and Ruth can very easily walk from Moab right into Bethlehem without being harassed and being accepted immediately, would indicate a fairly peaceful time or relations between the Hebrew tribes and the Moabites. Of course, we don't know exactly when that took place, and we have another complication, and that is that most scholars don't think that the book of Ruth was in fact written during the period of the Judges. After the exile, when Isaiah and Nehemiah came back and started trying to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem and so forth, one of the things that they had, especially Ezra, was a strong religious reform which banned all intermarriages of any kind. There's a marriage between a Jew and any Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, and so forth. Against that kind of a background, a number of people have argued that the Book of Ruth, again, was written as a polemic against the very rigid religious reforms of Ezra. That is, whether you can trust the historical accuracy of it or not, it's questionable. It may have been produced simply to say, oh, remember there was the time when the great-grandmother of King David was a Moabite. We received her in the family very warmly, and therefore we shouldn't be as opposed as Ezra and Nehemiah think we should. So, that's possible. That, we, other than the Book of Ruth, which is questionable day, we really don't have much information as to what was happening between Moab or Edom during the period of the Judges. Ammon in the Jordan Valley seems to have been some part. We do have, should take that back, there's one passage, I think in the third chapter of the book of Judges, which does talk about the Moabites coming down and capturing Jerusalem for a brief period of time. And one of the Hebrew judges and attacks the Moabites in Jerusalem and kills 10,000 of them, and then they retreat across the Jordan River. Again, there's no indication that any of the judges pursued. And a little questionable whether there would have been 10,000 Moabites in Jerusalem in order to kill them. But, that is one story of contact between the Hebrews and the Moabites during the period of the judges. Okay, David's rise to power. Most people, I think, just automatically have a tendency to think of David as the great king. He's the one that's, the Bible says, that won God's heart and so forth, the very virtuous man and so forth. If you read the biblical text very carefully, David was really quite a conniver. You might remember that Saul was trying to capture David to kill him, mainly because he thought that David had his eye on becoming king of Israel, which I'm sure in fact he did. And Saul wanted to ensure that either Jonathan or another one of his sons would in fact follow him as the king of Israel. with Saul and Jonathan's death on Gilboa around 1000 BC. Oh, wait, before we get to that, you might remember the story where David is constantly running through the wilderness of Judea trying to get away from Saul. What you might not remember then, one of the ways in which he manages finally to get away from Saul is to retreat to Philistine territory. And he serves, in fact, as not only a vassal, but a mercenary for the Philistines, while Saul, on the other hand, is fighting the Philistines in the northern part of Israel, in the northern part of Israel. What David does, according to the biblical text, is that he was raiding people in the southern part around the Negev, the Amalekites, one of which was another two or three of them, who were the enemies of the Philistines, but they were also the enemies of the southern tribe of Israel, which was Judah. So what he was doing was, in fact, claiming to the Philistines that I'm fighting against your enemies, which he was, but then he was taking. Time for Saul to confront the Philistines at the Battle of Gilboa, David volunteers to go along with the Philistines to fight. The text indicates that the Philistines don't quite trust David that much. Therefore, they say, no, you can stay here, watch over him. As soon as David hears that Saul has been killed, he goes immediately to Hebron, which is the center of power for the southern tribes, and has himself proclaimed king of the southern tribes. That's an interesting thing, too. We talked about the tribal confederacy and the independence that the early Hebrew tribes felt. It's a clear indication of it that immediately after Saul's death, the southern tribes break their alliance with the northern tribes and proclaim David king rather than one of Saul's surviving sons, whose name is Ishbaal. I don't know why it is, but it seems that throughout the world you seem to have a kind of inbuilt animosity between people in the north and in the south. And you certainly find that in ancient Israel. The southern tribes and the northern tribes just didn't get along, unless there was some enemy that was powerful and forced them to come together. Ishbaal was a surviving son of Saul who did follow his father as the king of the northern tribes. He has an interesting name. The first part of it is Ish, which in biblical Hebrew means man. And of course, Baal is the major Canaanite fertility god. There are a number of names like this which incorporate Baal into it, especially in the period of the Judges, which again would indicate, would see as an indication that Canaanite influence is very strong. You would think the good Yahweh worshiper would call his son the man of Baal. In fact, in Judges chapter 10, we also get a clear indication that during the period of the Judges, there was a religious problem with a lot of the Israelites serving the gods of the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Canaanites, and the Philistines. So we know that syncretism was a problem in ancient Israel throughout the Old Testament period. Following David's proclamation of king of the southern tribes, or basically this tribe of Judah and Benjamin, Ishbaal reigns for a couple of years, but there was a tremendous feud between the family of David and the family of Saul. Within 2 years, Ishbaal is dead, as well as all of his brothers and sisters. At that point, the northern tribes come down and ask David to reign as king over them as well. There is some debate. We know from the biblical text that David reigns as king in Hebron for 7.5 years. It's said that Ishbaal dies after 2 years, so we don't know exactly what the chronology is, because according to one account, again, David, after 2 years, takes over as king of the northern tribes. The other account, it's 7.5 years before he takes over rule of the northern tribes. In any case, once that happens, you get a very interesting phenomenon, too. There had been this animosity between the tribes of the north and the south, and David had to decide then where he was going to put his capital. If he kept it in Hebron, which was his stronghold, certainly that would have offended the northern tribes. If he could have gone to a place like Shechem, which was the first, more or less, central sanctuary of the combined tribes, but again, that would be probably viewed by his constituency in the south as selling them out. What he did instead was went up to Jerusalem, which was a Jebusite city, which was right on the border between Judah in the south and the other tribes in the north, captured Jerusalem, and basically set up his capital on neutral territory. Yeah, to use an analogy in the United States, you could say he established a Washington type, D.C. type of capital, which had not been claimed by any other tribe in the past. So it was more or less his personal property. I should point out it's not quite that simple from the biblical text. What I've been referring to is 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 6, which talks about David's capture of Jerusalem. But there's a couple other passages which make some problems. Okay, the Samuel passage coincides with what's said in Joshua chapter 15, verse 63, and that is in Joshua 15:63. It says that the tribe of Judah was unable to capture Jerusalem. Actually, I should put that as in Judges chapter 1, verse 8. On the other hand, it said that the tribe of Judah did capture Jerusalem. Again, this is back in the period of Joshua. Whereas 2 Samuel 5:6 indicates that it had been a Jebusite town right up until the time of David, and that's why when he took it over, there was no question that it was his personal city, not a part of the tribe of Judah. Again, there have been attempts to explain this difference, and one possible attempt is to say that initially the tribe of Judah was unable to capture Jerusalem. Soon after that, according to this account, they did capture Jerusalem. In the intervening time then, the Jebusites rebelled, took the city back, and when David came back on the scene, he had to take the city again. That's, again, one way of making all the pieces fit, although most people would say, no, we just got conflicting conditions and it can't actually be explained away. What's that? Again, the Jebusites, it's referred to as a Jebusite city. That's really not too helpful, because the next question then is, well, who in the world were the Jebusites? But that's a question that, again, is very difficult to answer. It's like, ultimately, who were the Canaanites, or the Gergesites, or the Perizzites, or the Ammonites, Moabites, and Edomites? We know that they were linguistically, culturally, closely related, but we really don't know where almost any of these groups came from, the Philistines being a possible exception. We know that they're coming at least from the Aegean, but then still there are a lot of debates as to what their actual people were. How distinctly different, we don't know. They certainly are mentioned as a specific group with an individual identity, but they seem to be located in Grand Rapids.
Do you have to know what
skeletal traits and so forth to test out some of the theories, whether Lapp was right, if these people were coming down from southern Russia, or if they were in fact coming from Mesopotamia, or at least if those have more genetic characteristics similar to Mesopotamian people than to southern Russian people, to what extent they were marrying and so forth. Again, though, a problem that you would have, it seems to me right offhand, say if you dug in Jerusalem in late Bronze levels, or say early Iron Age levels, and you find a cemetery, or you find several different tombs, and you start studying these characteristics, and maybe you do notice differences in certain individuals. The problem is the bones that you're dealing with, how do you decide whether what you've got here is an old Jebusite or an Israelite or a Canaanite who walked into town and fell on the dead and then stayed away in the Jerusalem area? It's, again, certain types of people, the Philistines among them, have very distinctive pottery, and they are, that you can identify, so with these grave offerings and say, well, this is obviously a Philistine burial. Others are very difficult to know. Okay. In any case, however David came into possession of Jerusalem, he got it. We know from the excavations of Kathleen Kenyon that the size of Jerusalem during the Davidic period was very small. It appears as if he simply did a little bit of repair on the old Jebusite wall, but there are not major sections of the Davidic wall, or what you can say is strictly the Davidic wall, still in Jerusalem. If you go to Jerusalem and want to visit the city of David, you'll probably be very disappointed. It's not inside the old city as you see it now. It's just on a little hill in the southeast corner of the old city, the little hill of Ophir, which has the Gihon Spring and the subtle pool underneath it. You would think, again, that there would be more archaeological remains from the Davidic period, especially in Jerusalem, if that was his capital, but very, very little information or remains have been found from the time of David. There seems to be a fairly clear explanation for this. We do know from Josephus and other ancient writers that there were some major constructions in Jerusalem. Herod the Great was certainly one of the major builders, and he seemed to have quarried out a lot of stone, probably from the Davidic city when he built the temple, and so forth. And it would appear at least that that is the reason that we don't find the remains from the Davidic period in Jerusalem. Also, we have the problem that David himself, in a sense, was like Saul. Primarily, he was a military leader. And the main accomplishments of David were that not only did he finally defeat the Philistines and the Canaanites, and there again, we should probably be careful. Some people feel that once David comes to power, certainly politically, militarily, the Israelites ruled the land. But that doesn't mean that all of these other people were annihilated. And in fact, the fact that Canaanite, Ammonite, Moabite, Edomite religion continue to have a great impact on the religion of the people living in the Old Testament, that is, the Israelite religion, indicates that there still were a lot of Canaanites and a lot of Philistines and a lot of Ammonites, Moabites, and Edomites around, even though they were subjugated to David. Yeah, primarily David, though, is a general, and he didn't embark, at least as far as we know, he didn't embark on any major building projects. Therefore, we wouldn't really expect to find any remains. There were many remains. Of interest, of course, during the Davidic period, when it comes comes to the archaeology of this part of the river, you remember there is a story about David's siege of Rabbah, which was ancient Ammon, in which not only was he able to conquer the Ammonites and subdue them, but also managed to get rid of Uriah the Hittite's, or Bathsheba's husband, Uriah the Hittite, to be able to go ahead and marry him. Again, it's fairly disappointing if you go on to the Ammon Citadel and look for Iron Age ruins. There's just not very much there. And again, the reason seems to be that in the later period, the Byzantine period, the Islamic period, also the Islamic period, the site was pretty much cleaned off and rebuilt. So that you do find Iron Age pottery and a few fragments of Iron Age walls, but no major occupation, although we are quite certain, especially from some later inscriptions, that Ammon was in fact the capital of the Ammonites. Sort of the most visible Iron Age remains in the vicinity of Ammon are these towers. I imagine everybody's familiar with Wadi Mafouf right near the registration center. Those Rujums are a bit of a problem. Originally, there were at least 19 of them that encircled Ammon to protect the Ammonite kingdom. And actually, there were some number of other ones that you could consider a part of that defensive system. One that you haven't visited, it's fairly close here, right out on the edge of Wadi Sir. You have a large square Iron Age tower, and just up the street here, about two blocks, there's also another very ruinous Iron Age tower. And if you want to spend a nice afternoon on a very quick trip, go into the Bekaa Valley, and right about when you get to the center of the refugee camp, if you look off to the west, you'll see some very large Iron Age towers in there as well. Actually, there's Iron Age towers scattered all through the Bekaa Valley. There's some Iron Age towers up at this new town that's being built now. So the problem is that those towers, there's still a lot of debate about them. If you read the article on Ammon in the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, the little article was written by Siegfried Horn, who did the excavations of Heshbon. He mentions the fact that of the two towers that have been excavated, one is Kibbutz HaJar out near Wadi Sir. That seems to date quite early as the 12th century BC. And from that you might assume that all of the Iron Age towers around Ammon are 12th century, very early, right in the end of the period. On the other hand, Wadi Mafouf, the same article says, after excavation, was proved to be Roman in date. In fact, I think that's very questionable. Probably was an original Ammonite tower, which was reused in the Roman period and cleaned out some of all the Iron Age pottery that's come out. But there is quite a question as to whether these Iron Age towers, two primary explanations are that they are very early, that they were built probably around the time of Saul and David, that is right around 1000 BC in order to protect Ammon, or that they date to just after the death of Solomon, around 922, when Ammon rebelled, managed to get out from under the Israelite yoke and refortified the kingdom.
When you say protect them, are these watchtowers or are these towers from which you can get
out? I would imagine both. I mean, they're not very large. Twice as large as this room. Certainly they're not places with a large number of people to live. But they probably did serve both as watchtowers and then stations from the small target. Okay, during the reign of David then, David was able to subdue the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Edomites. Solomon, taking over around 960, was able to hold the kingdom together. Again, Solomon, you would suspect that you'd find more remains from the Solomonic period, since Solomon was quite wealthy. One of the more important finds that you might say one of the few cases in which a biblical text can, with some degree of certainty, be connected with an actual archaeological remain. In the book of 1 Kings, chapter 9, verse 15, it talks about Solomon and his program to fortify the sites of Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. And at those three sites, also Jerusalem, but at Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer, what they have found are some large monumental gates dating to the Iron Age, right about the time of Solomon. And it does appear that these quite likely were built under Solomon's supervision. And that particular biblical text may, in fact, refer to the Solomonic gates. Again, if you read some of the older literature, you'll find references to Solomon's stables at the site of Megiddo. We know from the biblical text that both David and Solomon made a lot of their money by trading horses and chariots. And from that particular text, once this very large, difficult to explain installation was found in Megiddo, dating to the Iron Age, it was said that these must be the stables of Solomon, where he put all his horses. In fact, we found now that they aren't Solomonic at all. They're about 100 years later, dating to the time of Ahab, the son of Amon. But this is one example of Solomonic architecture. Again, rather surprisingly, in Jerusalem, very little from the period of Solomon was being found. We do know that Solomon constructed the temple platform, the temple platform that you go and see today with the Dome of the Rock on it, is dates from the time of Herod, who rebuilt and expanded the Solomonic platform. But he did build the platform, and part of that platform, you could say, dates to the Solomonic period. Although, if you go in the presence of a tour guide, very often you'll hear them say that the Wailing Wall is the wall of the Solomonic temple. That is completely untrue, because we don't have any Solomonic remains at the Wailing Wall. The lowest courses are Herodian, not actually walls of the temple, but probably walls of the outside retaining wall or outside perimeter. And again, you might say that when Herod rebuilt the temple, he may have built that outside perimeter along the same lines that Solomon did, but we don't have the actual remains of the Solomon. It's not the actual wall of the temple, but it's the wall of the outer perimeter and the outer precincts. There are a few, some of the big stones that you see there. Again, if you stand back and look at that wall, well, you can see two or three different phases. But certainly nothing so long. Also, the stone quarries in Jerusalem were also thought to be Solomonic, although they all were in a later period too, so we don't have anything definite from the Solomonic period in Jerusalem. Although we know that the West Bank was controlled by both David and Solomon, that there must have been, as biblical texts say, that a number of battles that they fought in order to subdue this East Bank. As far as I know, there's never been any excavation in Jordan which has found, say, a destruction level that you could attribute to Solomon or to David. You know, there may be one that exists, but at least so far. Okay, we just got out of time. Just to mention one other thing. At 922 is an important date at the death of Solomon. The so-called kingdom splits up. And a very important passage relating to that is in 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 16. I do want to read that. 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 16. Actually, Solomon's downfall, to a large extent, seems to have stemmed from his ambitious building program. Again, he centered in Jerusalem, although in a sense that's neutral territory. It is closer to the south. There had always been this tension between the northern tribes and the southern tribes. When Solomon got very wound up in his building projects, he placed a lot of demands on the northern tribe. In fact, the north is a much richer area, agriculturally and so forth, and he depended more on the north than on the south for taxes and labor. In fact, we're told we put large numbers of people from the northern tribes in the forced labor in his building projects. And at his death, when his son Rehoboam wants to take over, there's a entourage that comes representing the northern tribes to Jerusalem to say, look, you've got to be a little bit easier on us than the old man was, or we're going to need the Confederacy. Solomon's son was unconvinced and said, well, you think you can have it bad on my father, I'm going to make it more difficult for you, to which then he gets this response. When all of Israel saw that the king did not hearken to them, the people answered the king, what portion have we in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel, look now to your own house, O David. So at that point, the northern tribes pull away, leaving Judah and Benjamin, under the Davidic monarchy, and they set up their own monarchy back in Shechem, which was, again, the original place where the tribes had started out. We had mentioned before also the interesting thing that Jeroboam the first, who's the first king of the northern tribes, and besides setting up his capital in Shechem, sets up two sanctuaries, one in Bethel in the south and one at Dan in the north, and places golden calves in those sanctuaries. Now that's caused a lot of debate. Whether the calves themselves were worshipped. Some scholars feel that the calf or the bull was seen as simply the throne upon which invisible Yahweh sat, and so there was still Yahweh worshiping. It seems that a more plausible explanation is probably that the northern tribes, which were more influenced by patriarchal traditions, certainly the Jacob traditions in the south, were trying to revitalize or reinstitute the old El worship, since El, the Canaanite god, the god of the patriarchs, was often represented as poor. Again, that's another people issue that's impossible. Okay, this time we'll deal with the latter part of the Iron Age, which does have a little more archaeological evidence. Okay,
that last passage talks about